So David Letterman is retiring.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to process that, because it's like this is the first time you've had like this guy who's been part of your entire life since you've had the power to make intelligent decisions about what you watch on TV. And now I'm a grown adult and he's not going to be around anymore. It's like, oh,
it's a moment. I mean, I remember first seeing him in 1982 in the first year he was on. But I was too young to understand what I was seeing. I was on a trip with my family, and it was like my mom's high school reunion, and they were out late, and I had the TV on in the hotel room, and I was like, who is this strange man? But a couple years later, I went back to watch Late Night, and, you know, it was – I don't want to oversell it, but I'm not sure I can. It was transformative in how I understood culture and comedy and television and – speaking and relating to other people. And I mean, I can't even begin. I would say he is the most formative, important creative figure, perhaps, in my entire conception of pop culture.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wouldn't disagree.
He's huge for me. I mean, I remember seeing the morning show when that was originally on, because, you know, when I'd stay home sick from school, and here was this thing that wasn't a game show. What was this? And it wasn't Mike Douglas. It was very much not Mike Douglas. And then I think there was one night in 82 or 83 where we stayed up for like a lunar eclipse or a meteor shower or something. And it was the summer, and that just happened to be on when we came back inside, because my grandfather stayed inside and watched TV. And it happened to be a night that Bob and Ray were on. And I already knew who Bob and Ray were. So it was like, oh my God, here's someone else. You know, I knew Johnny Carson had them on, but here's someone else who actually likes Bob and Ray. Oh my God. And from that point on, it was sort of like whenever I could stay up to see him, I would. I had a very indulgent mother. Thank goodness. And so, yeah, I mean, I remember when the top 10 list started, and I still remember the dancing Lavoris instead of the dancing Waters. And he had this little fountain in front of the desk, and he would hit a button and it would start shooting up. I remember the episode where the camera gradually turned 360 degrees in mm-hmm. a circle over the course of the hour. I remember the anniversary show that they did on an airplane.
Flying to Miami, wasn't it? Something like that. That was the time, you know, 84 through, you could pick, but round and then. I mean, I remember when the top 10 list started. The first when I started watching regularly, it was, you know, there was the Chris Elliott, the guy under the seats, and the fugitive guy, and all of that crazy Chris Elliott stuff. And the crazy off format episodes, the suit of Velcro, the suit of suet, which didn't really work very well.
I thought the bigger ones for me were when I think the first full episode I ever saw at the time it was actually aired was where you're used to the opening themes, the opening credits, and all that, the normal open, but they just cut to Dave like in a football jersey behind the desk in his actual like NBC office, saying, "Yeah, it's way, way too hot to do a show today."
We sent
the audience home. We're just, it's just too hot to do a real show. So we're just gonna.
That was Terry Garr in the shower, wasn't it?
Yep. say yelling with considerable sincerity and venom, because basically in the role of an older brother, Letterman sort of bullied her into like showering. Of course, the doors were covered with towels, but just like she's just shouting from the back, "I hate you." And it was that sort of stuff where tuning in every single night, you've got the most rigid conventions of almost any TV show. On the talk show format, where the set is always the same, no matter who does this show, no matter what channel it's on, it's always a desk, and then to the left of the desk, a guest chair. There is a bandstand, and here's the format of the show, done since time immemorial. And for like the first time ever, you have a show where it has that form, but they're going to use that just as a launching off point for all kinds of digressions. And it's when I wrote a blog post about Letterman just a few days ago, coincidentally enough, I pointed out that Letterman is a lot like the iPhone or the Mac, where you don't appreciate years later how important that change was. What you have to do is you have to recognize that, look, before Letterman came on, all TV shows, talk shows were like this. And then after Letterman came on, all shows were like Letterman. Everybody coming up with a new show, it was doing something that was Letterman-esque. And you don't do that unless you're really an innovator. And I'm just sorry that younger people today don't have the ability to really see what a break his show was from what was going on before then.
Well, I mean, the people largely running talk shows now, other than David Letterman, are people in their 40s who grew up like us watching David Letterman. I mean, he owns the format. And I remember showing some strange amount of maturity, I guess, for being a 17-year-old or whatever. I remember watching Johnny Carson. I taped the Carson. So I had a VCR, and I taped the Carson monologue, and I taped David Letterman. I watched them usually in the morning before going to school. So like 6:30 in the morning, I would wake up, and I would turn on Carson and Letterman and watch it sort of half asleep, and letting my mind, all that stuff, just poured into my half-awake consciousness. And I remember thinking about Carson that I thought his monologue was great, and yet I also had that sense that sense of being a young person and saying, well, this is the old school, this is the old man. And yet Letterman's respect for him was so great that I realized, okay, this is how it works. And I do remember realizing this as a teenager. This is how it works, is you grow up with somebody and you venerate them, and then when you take over and you do something that's different, but you also revere what they did. And I could see Letterman doing it with Carson. And I remember thinking to myself, one of these days, if we're lucky, people are going to be thinking this way about David Letterman. And that has come to pass. He's now the guy who has defined the format to the point where it's almost kind of boring, because every talk show is like that, even though, you know, it wasn't like that before David Letterman and Meryl Marco, his former girlfriend and head writer of Late Night with David Letterman. Those two did some crazy stuff in the early to mid 80s that and that's the show that everybody else is doing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about it after Andy's post the other day, which was beautiful, by the way.
Fantastic, yeah.
And, you know, I think I'm a little more charitable towards Fallon and Seth Meyers than you were, but I agree otherwise. You know, it's because I've been watching those, and, you know, they're fine, but I kind of, if I'm doing anything else, I forget which one is on, which is maybe not a good thing. They're so slick and polished, and they both have the blue background and the wood paneling, and it's really kind of disconcerting how prepackaged it all is. But I look at all the different shows today, like, you know, between them and Conan and The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, and all of these things are influenced by Letterman, and the sitcoms that have taken elements from that. And I mean, How I Met Your Mother, Letterman writers. You know, and then I look back at The Tonight Show. Some of the shows that those writers went on to do were F Troop, Hong Kong Phooey. You know, it's not quite the same legacy. I mean, Carson, I love Johnny Carson, but there's something about what they were doing at Late Night and then how they evolved. I mean, they did a really fine tuning of it when they went to The Late Show. And so it was a similar sensibility with a little more of the Carson veneer. And I thought they blended it very nicely, because I remember worrying about it when he moved up.
Yeah. I thought it was more like, you know how like the Doonesbury strip, they weren't having the characters age in real time. And so after like 10, 15 years, all the characters were still in college. So then Gary Trudeau went on a short sabbatical. Then when we came back, they decided, okay, let's just say that everybody's 15 to 20 years older than they were before the summer sabbatical started. I thought that in retrospect, this was a lot like what they did when they made it went from a Late Night to Late Show, where it's more like, okay, let's pretend that David Letterman is no longer it's as though he's been playing a 32-year-old Maverick for 10 to 15 years. So now let's pretend that he's now 55 years old and he's playing a grown-up 11:30 p.m. talk show host. And it certainly took them a little while to settle into that groove of how are we going to continue to do the same show but make it more mature and more 11:30 than 12:30. But they got there pretty quickly. And now Dave is a Kennedy Center honoree, which was not something that Jay Leno was ever going to get. Certainly nothing that anybody who's on TV right now is going to get in that time slot.
Yeah.
Maybe
Colbert.
Late Show.
Maybe.
I have some issues. Yeah, I mean, Stewart and Colbert, there's an argument to be made that those guys
Stewart. Colbert more than Stewart.
Well, yeah.
There's in terms of putting in a 20 or 30 year career that gets them into the category of Carson, Letterman, just legend sort of stuff.
We'll see. But I mean, yeah. So my point was going to be that when Late Show happened, you know, I think you're right, Andy. I think it had to change because even though it was, for me, it was sort of, I mean, it was triumphant because it's like, you know, my guy, he got what he wanted. And even he didn't get the Tonight Show, but he got this. But at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, how is it going to change? And the fact is it did change and it was trying to be broader in a certain way. But I think you're right that part of it was about the fact that he was not the... I mean, the NBC show was, we have a terrible budget and we're on after Johnny Carson and NBC barely tolerates us and we are rebels. And when you got the Ed Sullivan Theater renovated for millions and millions of dollars and you're on CBS with a huge multi-million dollar contract and a giant budget at 11:30, you're not the rebels anymore. So they had to change, and they were still wacky. It was not, you know, it was never going to be as wacky as it was in the 80s. But it was sort of the David Letterman version of the Tonight Show that he wanted to do and didn't get a chance to do at NBC. And so, you know, it was different. And as I aged and Dave aged, I watched it less and less. And I don't watch David Letterman regularly anymore. I don't watch any. The only show that I actually watch with any regularity at all now that would be considered a late night show is The Daily Show. But that's okay. It's an interesting transformation to think about how he went from being this madman who was, you know, even if barely tolerated by NBC, there were times when he was not tolerated by NBC at all, when he's got a megaphone, he's shouting at the Today Show while it's recording, things like that. But at the same time, you know, you become an establishment figure. He's got he's the longest tenured late night talk show host in the format now, which is crazy. Yeah. 33 years on the air.
Well, I remember when GE first bought NBC, and they did a thing where he brought flowers to the main desk.
A bowl of oranges.
To the corporate headquarters. And got
the security guard is like, no, you can't come in here, And they broadcast the whole thing.
And they gave him the GE handshake, which is when the guy, when he rolls out his hand and the guy moves his hand toward Letterman's hand and then pulls away. Yoink. Yeah. The old GE handshake. But but when you're on a first name basis with Leslie Moonves, the guy who runs CBS, hard to be the rebel anymore, right? So it had to change. Yeah. And that's life.
I just remember when we watched that originally and my dad looked at me and he said, he's not going to be at NBC very long. And lo and behold.
Yeah. I wonder if I can be a little bit too harsh at, you know, people like Fallon who are real just company men all the way in terms of how they approach the show. But to be fair, I wonder if there's really opportunities for this generation's Letterman to do the 12:30 time slot what Letterman was allowed to do with 12:30. It really was... You know, we're gonna put you in this time slot. We've had contracts with you for a long time. We believe in your talent. This is the slot that's opened up for you, and maybe it'll be good, maybe it'll be bad, but we'll see how you do in that time slot. I'm not sure if any network would take that kind of a risk, even when Conan took over that slot, 12:30. he was just on 1 week contracts for forever until they decided they'd this really is the best we can do right now because we have no plan C lined up. And it was only because of that lack of planning for NBC that he got to get that extra year to really dial that show in. So it's this is just not the next Letterman is really going to be the guy who's doing a podcast or the guy who's doing YouTube videos because it's the only place that'll give him that kind of freedom.
Yeah, well, it's either that or it's somebody on cable, or even more likely, it looks like it's somebody who is a bit player on a cable show somewhere that, you know, which, you know, not that John Oliver was a bit player, but John Oliver and we all, you know and love him on the Bugle podcast as well. But, you know, John Oliver on The Daily Show or the Saturday Night Live people who have gone on to success so far, you have gotten these jobs in the NBC late night machine is the Lorne Michaels machine now, essentially. And so they put in their time on Saturday Night Live, and then you get rewarded with a step up, and that's sort of their system. But so there are places, but you're right. I think the idea that they would take somebody and give him a daytime show and say, well, this is really not the right place for you, and then give him this late night show and say, well, see what happens. That sort of crazy experimentation is much more likely to happen on YouTube or on a podcast or something like that, and then end up, you know, spreading into the mainstream. I think you're absolutely right. But this is all part of life. As we talk about him retiring, this is all part of life because the guys who have their shows now are the establishment, essentially the new establishment, and they're all doing their version of Letterman's show, which means the time is now ripe for somebody else to come crashing in and say, I respect you guys, but I'm going to totally deconstruct your show now and do something completely different.
Yeah. Well, I think the only real analog now to the way Letterman went is Stewart and Colbert. Because, I mean, part of the reason Letterman got the show in the daytime was because Carson liked him. And he had been a guest host on The Tonight Show so long. And then Carson actually produced Late Night.
Yep.
And, you know, it just sort of, he had that umbrella of Carson with NBC. And so Stewart saying, you know, Stephen Colbert could do this character and we could do a different kind of, you know, political, topical show that isn't just The Daily Show Part 2. It's, you know, it's a very similar kind of thing. Now, it's been interesting to see.
Well, and Letterman does that with Craig Ferguson. He owns that show.
Right. I can't wait to see what happens with John Oliver on his own with the former head writer from The Daily Show. You know, how is it going to be different? How is it going to be the same?
Yeah, it's a different, it's a different show, right? I mean, they're doing, in some ways, their show is more of Weekend Update.
Yeah. Right.
The Daily Show as well, more Weekend Update than a traditional talk show. And then yet there's an interview segment at the end of it, which is, I find that bizarre. Although even with Letterman now, the comedy bits at the front are much more programmed in and the talk is loaded on the back side. So that's an interesting way that format has changed dramatically.
But at least the talk is still there.
Yeah.
What would break my heart is if we really see we really see this trend where the only thing they want to put into that half hour or that hour are things that could go viral the next day, where they feel as though it's just deadly to have 10 minutes of conversation between two people, even though it's only 2 minutes, even though there's a pre-interview and there's that blue sheet of paper with every single really good story they got out of all the pre-interviews. To this day, I think that one of the best late night talk show hosts was actually Bob Costas, at least in the network time slot, because this, you talk about low expectations. How about you put me on at 1:30 in the morning? Where the understanding is, Bob, I don't know how much, you know, I don't know if you realize how much it costs to shut down the entire, all this broadcast towers and then fire them up again in 3 hours. It really costs a lot more money than it does simply to pay you to be on TV and just, you know, prevent us from having to turn things on and off all the time. But he would just simply have, here's a guest. There is no audience. There's nobody to play to. You don't have to worry about how your jokes are landing. All you have to do is concern yourself with this one-on-one conversation. And to this day, one of the finest memories I have of watching a talk show guest was Bill Murray and Bob Costas. And Bill's just simply telling the story about how he was in the city when John Lennon was shot, and he decided to go to Central Park and just see how people were dealing with it. And of course, he's Bill Murray. Even though it's not a big audience, he has this the gag that he had a little bit of comedy where he decided to like bring this little like tape player, just have this background music playing, and as soon as he starts talking about like what he was feeling at the memorial service, then he just. Not a planned moment. He just realizes that, okay, I don't want to have this cheesy music in the background while I'm telling this serious story. And it's just, it's these unplanned things that cannot happen until there is that connection, that conversation. And if talk shows get reduced to here's 5 minutes of banter so that we can plug your movie, and then we get to play Super Wingo Password with a member of the audience. Yes. But what you don't know is that the member of the audience doesn't speak English. Let's see how this is going to work. It's like, okay, fine, whatever.
Well, then it's just a comedy show and it's not a talk show anymore. Yeah. I mean, meanwhile, while that's happening on NBC, you've got... the format can go a bunch of different ways, and it's sort of interesting to see how you've got Craig Ferguson's sort of strange, long, you know,
his own wavelength.
Like which is fascinating. And I had a bunch of people today on Twitter say, oh, maybe Craig Ferguson will be on 11:30. I was like, I don't know. He feels like a 12:30 kind of guy to me. Like,
I don't think he'll do it.
No, I like him.
They call it the Prince of Wales clause in his contract, that it's his right to refuse the late show.
Yeah, so, but
I don't think he'll work. Yeah,
I'm certain that remember that even when NBC gave Conan the Tonight Show, they had an out that simply said that, yes, I know this is a huge pile of money, but it's still a pile of money we'd be willing to buy if we could solve you as a problem by giving you $40 million, we can make another $40 million.
Yeah.
So I don't see Craig Ferguson as replacing Dave, only because it's just. His format is just so resistant to any sort of a modification, and I don't think it would work at 11:30. And more to the point, he's like 50 years old.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure that I'm sure that whoever they're looking at is somebody who is at least 40 years old, but really kind of reads as 30 years old and has before they did anything that made them traditionally TV famous, already had a million Twitter followers.
Yeah.
And talking about formats, I mean, the other point I wanted to make is then you've got the Comedy Central stuff, which is, like I said, it's almost like a Weekend Update sort of thing, except, you know, Jon Stewart and Colbert, too, although Colbert, his interviews are coming from his character, which is interesting and strange, but can be very good. And Stewart's interviews can be very good. And in fact, while Jimmy Fallon is putting viral, wacky videos on, Jon Stewart does extra segments with... you know, Nate Silver, and puts them on the web so that you can talk even longer, right? So it's fascinating how the different interpretations of this format can be. And I am kind of fascinated in where it goes next. Some of the reports out there say that the only, I think the report I saw from somebody who's got some sources said that the only currently working host that CBS was talking to and interested in was Stephen Colbert, which is interesting. I think another TV critic I follow said that he thought that they would approach Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, but he couldn't see Jon Stewart saying yes because Jon Stewart seems quite comfortable doing what he's doing, and he's making a lot of money, and he's on a network that kind of owes most of its gravity to him, and it's a pretty good place to be.
Yeah. I was reading, as soon as I heard about this and got back to my computer, I knew that Mark Evanier would have some good things to say about it, because he's, for those of you who don't know his blog, you have to know his blog. He's been a professional writer in comics and TV since like 1972. Not only that, but he's really plugged into the entire like comedy scene, TV and stand-up. He used to hang out at the Comedy Store with Letterman, with Leno. If he has not had experience directly, he knows people have had those experiences. And so he made some interesting bits of speculation, one of which is that Letterman has such a good relationship with CBS management that perhaps there was a little bit of a handshake agreement saying that at some point it's going to be clear that this show is going to not be viable in a couple of years, at which point we'll have that conversation and I will agree to go to preserve my legacy the same way that Carson decided to preserve his own legacy. So he was speculating that they already have a guy, at least a handshake deal with the other guy, but they're not even going to start talking about that publicly for like 4 or 5 months to give Letterman the proper send off, at least for around this moment of this announcement.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It's funny. Stephen Colbert is almost 50. Craig Ferguson's 51, I think. It would be interesting if they plucked somebody out of obscurity, but I think you can't do that at 11:30.
Yeah. I don't know about that. The problem with Colbert is that why would he? It's sort of like trying to. It's sort of like some other tech company trying to woo Tim Cook away from Apple. No,
see, I'm going to disagree. I'm going to disagree with you for one reason.
I'm just saying that Colbert has created a show that is completely his own that really didn't exist before he created it. He's as much an innovator in that format as Letterman was with the talk show format. He would be basically giving up a show that's already very, very successful and very, very profitable to take over a format that he's never really done before in that way. I'm not sure how you'd make that pitch to him and say that this is what you would want for your next step in your career.
I think the only reason, if you're Stephen Colbert, that you want to do this, I mean, you might be up for the challenge. That happens. I wonder sometimes if I were Stephen Colbert, would I start getting frustrated that I was trapped in this character that I have to play on TV? Because Jon Stewart gets to be Jon Stewart, but Stephen Colbert has to be a character. He's not able, everything he does in that show has to be through the lens of this character that he's playing. It's a show long sketch every night. And I wonder sometimes when I watch that show and I see through the cracks at how brilliant this guy is, I wonder if sometimes he's like, geez, this is great and all, but I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. I don't want to be this character for the rest of my life. And if that's his feeling, if it's like, I think I could do this show with, I could do this without that. And the reason I'm doing this is as a contrast to Jon Stewart, because it works as a block, but I've proven myself, that would be the reason he would do it. And I'm not sure he feels that way, but that's the one wild card I have with him that I don't have with Jon Stewart is he is playing that character and he does it well, but does he really want to be that guy? Or does he want to be able to be himself a little bit more? I don't know.
I understand your point of view that way. how many, Hollywood Squares was still on like when I was a kid, and it took me a while. It made the Charlie Weaver guy in the lower left hand corner of Hollywood Squares that much sadder to realize that no, he used to be a very, very young comedian who developed this fake character, Charlie Weaver, but he got stuck in it. So now he's a legitimately old, he's not playing an old man anymore. He is an old man, and nobody has any idea that he actually had a career outside of this character. But the only thing I'd say that I would flip that around a little bit is that I would use that as an argument for why Jon Stewart might leave, because when I see him on The Daily Show, I really see a guy who's burned out. I don't think he invests as much in his performances as it is. I think he's waiting to get to the interview, and even then he doesn't find, excuse me, to my perceptions, he doesn't have that same level of engagement as he used to. Whereas I do get the impression that that Stephen Colbert, this is the sort of thing that keeps his mind agile, because during his interviews are brilliant in that character, because he wants to give, he has a climate specialist on because he thinks this is an important issue and we can get some great facts out there. But he has that, he also has the agility to make sure he can bring the funny as a guy who totally doesn't buy a single word that he's saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you could argue that David Letterman's playing a character too.
Oh yeah.
So yeah. Go ahead, David.
Well, I was going to say, I can imagine Colbert wanting the challenge of doing that kind of show just because he hasn't done it. But I think he really enjoys what he's doing. I mean, there's something. I mean, he came up through improv, so you have to be good at improv to be able to do those kind of interviews, and to manage to get the facts that you want this guest to say, even while you're disagreeing with everything he says, and being funny about it, instead of just saying, "Oh, I'm going to interview a guy,"
and there is a sense too that Colbert has in some ways eclipsed Jon Stewart in the sense that they won the Emmy. There's more talk about the Colbert Report, good and bad, but I mean, there's more talk, more buzz about it. I think it would be fair to say that you know, now the student has become the master or something like that. And so, you know, that could be perfect timing for Colbert to say, you know, I'm happy where I am. It could also be perfect timing for him to say, you know, I don't need to be here behind Jon Stewart. So I don't know. He's an intriguing guy.
I want a stronger lead in.
He is a very, very talented guy. And I think he could do that kind of job. It would be interesting if it was somebody out of the blue. I doubt that CBS is going to invest somebody we don't know, but it could be somebody who's not hosting a TV show, right? I mean, we've seen that sort of thing before. Seth Meyers doing the late night show is somebody who was not a host before, other than, you know, he was a Saturday Night Live guy. Jimmy Fallon, the same way. Is there somebody else out there who comes from a comedy background but is not what we think of as a talk show host? I saw some people mention Tina Fey today, although I think she's got a successful enough career and a life that she's not going to have that happen. I saw somebody mention Amy Poehler, which I thought was kind of interesting. She's 42. She's a very interesting, talented person. That would be outside the box. I think that would be interesting. It's going to be somebody like that, I think, probably more likely than anybody else, because they're going to want somebody who's 40 and not 50, and ideally somebody who is known in entertainment and is very talented comedically, but maybe isn't somebody who's been riding behind a desk. And maybe that's not so bad.
Well, I mean, one thing I was thinking, like, you know, I saw everyone going, oh, Late Night with Tina Fey, that would be great.
Well, it would be great, and, but it's not going to happen.
It would be great, but she's not going to go against Lorne Michaels. I mean,
well, that's true,
Saturday Night Live and 30 Rock, and, you know.
She would, but.
She might.
I want her to.
But,
it would be hard.
The one that I haven't seen anyone suggesting yet, I mean, I may have missed it, he's already got a little history appearing on Craig Ferguson a lot, and he's already doing a show for Viacom after Colbert Report. Chris Hardwick.
Hmm. I was going to say that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Because he's got personality. He's different. He's young-ish compared to, you know, at least I think he's only in his 40s.
Yeah.
Late 30s.
I think he just had his 40th birthday a little while ago.
He's 42.
Oh, well, there you go.
He's within 2 months of the same age as Amy Poehler, actually.
Oh, wow. And, I'd like to see what he could do in that format. That would be a little different.
Yep. Yeah.
I'd like to see him have a conversation with people. Because, again, I also miss Bob Costas and Tom Snyder. You know, it killed me when they replaced them with Greg Kinnear and Craig Kilborn. It was like, oh, oh, God, shoot me. I mean, one of my happiest memories was Bob Costas. I mean, the thing I liked about Costas was if he felt like it, he would just keep talking and they would cut it up into half-hour segments. And they did one where it was a full week of Mel Brooks. And so you're getting a solid 2 hours of Mel Brooks telling stories, a lot of which I haven't heard him tell anywhere else. And at the end of the third segment, Mel says, "Hey, Bob, why don't we do the last one in togas?" And they did the fourth episode, both of them in togas, and they didn't mention it. They just, it's like as if this is perfectly normal. Hmm. You know, it's brilliant. And, you know, I'd love to see that in late night again. So it'd be nice to see him try that.
Let me back up your endorsement because I feel like Leo McGarry in The West Wing, that episode where it says, I just can't, this slogan popped into my mind and I can't get it out of my head. Well, instead of Bartlett for America, I'm thinking Late Show with Chris Hardwick because he's young enough to be not perceived as the old guy for the younger demographic that I get at. He is nonetheless old enough to have lots and lots of experience at all the skills you need to hold down a show like this. I mean, one of the things I like about the Nerdist podcast is that it is a long interview with a wide range of people, both from Tom Hanks all the way down to, wow, I've never heard of this person, but apparently this guy is a friend of someone he knows on the comedy circuit. And it turns out to be a really good interview, but he doesn't have the sort of acid sarcasm with these interviews that Letterman could sometimes produce, and yet it's never a butt kissing festivities hour of saying, "Hi, you know, I think your show is awesome. You know how awesome your show is. Hey, I'm sorry, I'm doing Fallon again, but you know, not only that, but he's already got like a huge, huge online presence. So that's already another big thing. The other thing, though, is that, and this is, sounds like I'm joking here, but they can get him cheap.
Yeah.
If you wanted to get an Amy Poehler, you have to say, okay, well, I know that you've got lots of offers for what to do after Parks and Recreation, and I know that you've written successful movies. What we're asking you to do is to take a pay cut, or at least to be attracted to the idea of the semi-stability of having to come into an office every single day and prepare a show every single day. Whereas with Hardwick, you instantly go from Letterman, who at his peak, I think that he was getting something like $30 million a year. As the landscape changed, everybody had to take a pay cut, but I'm sure it was still like $10-15 million. Now you can cut that immediately down to, I don't know, less than five, less than three. I have no idea, but it's certainly going to be less expensive than getting someone who is already an established name brand. But the other big thing is that this is someone that we're not sick of already. And I think that once you can't run into the Chevy Chase problem where, oh, here's that guy that we've been seeing year after year and movie after movie and, you know, failed project after failed project. He's got name recognition, but not name saturation yet. So, yeah, I would be totally excited by that idea. And that's not even as a fan. This is as a looking at how pieces of jigsaw puzzles fit together and seeing that, my God, you've got a Hardwick shaped hole at your 11:30 slot. You should get something that's shaped like Chris Hardwick to actually fit into that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Any other final thoughts about this momentous? It feels momentous.
It feels momentous to me. It is. Our Twitter feeds are filled with like every famous. It's almost as if he was. It's almost as if he was in like an ocean liner disaster and presumed dead because every single famous. I remember the first time that I was on his show. He was always so witty and so urbane. It's like, my God, I'm so glad that someone like tweeted at me, "Hey, did you hear about Letterman retiring?" Because if I'd seen like the Letterman Letterman in trending topics, like, oh my God, they missed one of the bypasses and he's dead.
I scared some people on Twitter thought that he was dead. I had to tweet again. Yeah. I'd be like, no, he's just retiring. He's not dead.
I will say this as a final thought, though. I hate the idea of him leaving because, again, it's so hard to figure out how I'm going to budget like my daily routine now that, you know, taking a break to watch Letterman 11:30 is no longer even going to be an option. But there's a wonderful history of one of the best years that any talk show host has is the year after he's announced his retirement. Because yep. He himself is going to be sharper because he knows that the clock is ticking down. But also the guests that he is going to get is going to be incredible, and all of them are going to bring their A games too. So it used to be that the thing I was most looking forward to was September, which was maybe when Leno would make his first appearance back in the guest chair. But God, make him a co-host for a week, just see how well that goes down.
I mean it's. It's going to be interesting to see how all the others react now without having him on the chessboard. You know, because I have to say of the new NBC shows, I much prefer Seth Meyers, partly because he seems to be paying attention to his guests instead of fawning. Mm. And he's actually said, we will only have one to two musical guests per week. We're going to save that third segment for something that's interesting. Hmm. So he had the editor of the New Yorker on, you know, that's nuts for a late night show at this point, or at least on a network. And you know, he has authors. He had the author of a book about Toronto Mayor Rob Ford. And instead of just being a vehicle for cheap jokes about Rob Ford, I mean, how many times have we seen that photo on the Tonight Show now where he's, you know, leaning back and his eyes are wild. He actually had a conversation with the woman who is a reporter for the Toronto Star, I think.
Yep. She was on Daily Show too. Another good interview.
And it was all about who he is and why he's doing this and right. How nuts is that? And so he's hemmed in by being produced by Lorne Michaels on NBC, but he's at least trying to sort of wedge the door open and he did a really weird segment of trading cards, and here are different packs of different sets of trading cards, and you know that was just the vehicle for the jokes, but most of the jokes weren't funny. what was funny was in between each one, he goes, up, and another stick of gum. Refresh the stick of gum. And he keeps adding sticks of gum with each set of trading cards until he can barely speak. That was strangely funny. And the audience wasn't even really reacting to anything. And I'm sitting there just dying because it's like, this is weird, you know. So I'm kind of interested to watch what he does. And I mean, I like Ferguson. Although what amazes me is that it's basically the same show every night because it's the same comedy bits. It's the same running jokes. It's the same. It's like these slight variations. And it's funny. I mean, I can watch it for weeks on end and be fine. But I'm babbling here. I certainly can't see him adjusting that to 11:30.
So
it's going to be interesting watching them all adjust and shift and
time moves slow in late night. It really does. Yeah. I'm doing some Glenning now. My friend Tim Goodman, TV critic for the Hollywood Reporter. He always likes to point out this is a long game. It's a long game, and everybody's going to come, and they're going to watch the first show, and they're going to make their snap judgments, and they're going to go away. And then the battle really begins, and you got to check back in 6 months and a year, because these shows are not writ in a day or a week. It takes a long time, and that's just how it is. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes, and with David Letterman leaving, lots more interesting things there. But it's the end of an era. It's a big deal, and you know, I think there'll be much more to say about it in the next year. There will be plenty of time for us all to ponder what made him so significant. But certainly, he hit me right in the middle of my formative years with this kind of comedy. The way he presents himself, it is a part. When I started to think about this sort of thing, it was all like, well, what would Letterman do? I mean, really? And that's as ridiculous as that is. I mean, it's just, hits you at the right time in the right place when you're half awake at 6:45 in the morning, and then it's with you forever as an adult. So,
well, it's funny when I started writing fiction and then even when I started doing plays and stuff, and I like doing meta structures. I like having, like the structure outside where you see the actors talking about the characters they're playing and stuff like that. And people would say, where did you get this? Are you getting it from like Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Jorge Luis Borges? And, are you getting it from like European art films? I'm like, no, I'm getting it from Letterman.
Yeah.
But yeah. Letterman made me meta. And,
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, this is a big day. Thanks to you both for taking a little time to talk about it.
When you're in a time of mourning, you gather your friends who can understand the depth of your sadness around you.
I try to get the people who, my friends who understand me and understand why I feel this way.
We joke, but I'm betting that on his last night, I'm going to be like not bawling my eyes out, but like, I'm fine.
Oh, man.
I can't talk right now, but I'm fine.
Andy, don't even make me think about that yet. I'm not emotionally prepared. I am not prepared to have that, to even think about what that night's going to be like. I saw a tweet from Aaron Barnhart scroll by today, and I've known Aaron Barnhart. He was the TV critic at the Kansas City Star for a million years. You know Aaron Barnhart.
Before that, he created probably the first digital magazine that I was familiar with,
which was Late Show News. And
that's
I knew him
which I used to hand convert into a Newton message pad book every single because I had the development kit.
Wow. And I've known Aaron since we were both posters on Alt Fan Letterman back in the Usenet days in college. It's just amazing. So I saw a thing about Letterman scroll by from him, and I'm like, man, I mean, this is how it goes. I have these friends who have been, they're essentially lifelong friends at this point, who I met because we were talking about David Letterman. It's crazy. Anyway, you're right, Andy. We'll gather your friends closely and talk about things that are important to you. Thanks to you both for having this conversation.
Well, thank you. I should say one thing that
it's not a 2 hour long podcast.
But don't worry. This is the first episode of the weekly podcast, the countdown to No More Letterman.
Yeah.
We have plenty of time to talk about his hair. Plenty of time to talk about his suits.
Episode 52.
Okay, so why is he? He doesn't just wear loafers. It's the sort of loafer where there's just a toe box, and the rest of you can see his sock. What's that all about?
Clearly, Paul Schaefer should be in the running. And
oh God, no.
Hello, everybody. It's fabulous. My grandmother, who passed away in 1999, I remember watching. She used to watch late night TV, and I remember talking to her about it because she watched Johnny Carson. And she and I said, "Well, I love David Letterman." She says, "David Letterman is fine, but that Paul Schaefer, I just don't like him." Why does my grandmother not like Paul Schaefer? And to this day, I see Paul Schaefer, and I'm like, "Grandma didn't like you."
Well, actually, you know, I've just realized there's one silver lining. Around October, say, of 2015, the greatest wedding band ever is going to become available for booking. So, all of a sudden.
Yes. A moment of silence for Will Lee and Sid McGuinness not having a regular gig anymore.
Well, I just, you know, if when he goes off the air, I hope he doesn't completely disappear. And I'm kind of optimistic because he just did a book with artist Bruce McCall. That I saw them do a promo for it a couple of months ago on the show. It looked hilarious. I mean, it's a picture book, but it's not for kids. It's for adults. And I'm trying to find the title of it. I think it's This Land Is Your Land.
This Land Was Made For You And Me, But Mostly Me.
This Land Was Made For You And Me, But Mostly Me. There you go. Thank you. Yeah. And it is hilarious. And so I'm hoping he does more of that because he, you know... And I, you know, at the time I wondered if he did that just to flex the comedy muscle that he isn't using on the show.
One of my great sadnesses is that I remember very clearly Johnny Carson saying when he signed off, maybe when we come up with something we think we'd like you to see, we'll come back and we hope you'll welcome us. And it never happened.
And what did he do? He wound up faxing jokes to Dave on a daily basis because he couldn't. He loved doing it and it genuinely thrilled him to get those jokes on the air.
Do you remember the night that Carson came on the Late Show? He just like walked through and he sat down at the desk and he just kind of sat up and then he walked out
and he walked right back out.
But not because that was part of the bit. It was because it was surprise. It was a surprise walk on. It was the first time anybody in that studio audience had seen Carson since he retired a year earlier, and they would not stop cheering. And you could see that even Dave had time to simply walk over and sit in the guest chair. Pleased as hell just to see, just to be in a guest chair next to Johnny Carson, and just it would not. He kept signaling for okay. Let's settle down, and finally, okay, I give up. I gotta go. Bye.
He was considering, do I say something behind the desk? And he's like,
What do I say? And then no. There's nothing I can say. I am glad though that Letterman. We will wind this show down. I will stop talking after this. We've got a lot of things to talk about. I'm sorry, we got a lot of emotions stirring
here in
around.
Episode one of the David Letterman Countdown Podcast.
We'll cost us this. We'll cut him into a second half. We'll be starting our second half hour. I am now wearing my top hat. Everyone else will be wearing their top hats. But I like the idea that Carson, as has become more clear since. More people have written about him after his death. He really had nothing to go for. He was a very lonely person.
Yeah.
He basically spent most of his time on his yacht alone. He was married in name pretty much, but the understanding that the wife is just going to leave him alone until that one time a month he actually needed her to, come over and talk, whatever. Letterman has a wife. Letterman has a kid. Letterman seems to have a life plugged into a community in Montana that he really, really likes. And also the other thing that he has that Carson didn't have is YouTube. So if he did decide that he wanted to not even do anything structured and formal, but as his kid becomes 12, 13, 14 years old and they start, doing things together, I like to think that we will see something maybe short of Jay Leno's garage, but still he'll have a way to still have his hand in comedy. He worked very, very hard and he deserves to be the dean of TV talk show host, and I hope that he has time to enjoy and savor and appreciate all the love and respect that's going to be thrown his way.
Comedians in Montana getting coffee.
I was thinking comedians in rivers fly fishing, but
sure.
Someone made a joke that that after he retires, Leno and Letterman are going to be doing a show called "Comedians in Cars Collecting Unemployment."